Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. For reasons beyond our control and beyond his control, we have been unable to connect this hour with our guest, Vali Nasser. We will do our very best to reschedule with him. And for now, we will bring you an archive edition of Think, and that is what you'll hear now. You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How and when and why do you run? Do you do it for the sheer pleasure of moving your body through space, for the health benefits of aerobic exercise, or, go ahead and admit it, only when chased? Many people plagued by injuries eventually have to give up running and accept that the human body just wasn't made to do it for long distances. But after spending time with a reclusive tribe of Indians in northern Mexico who run two-day races just for the fun of it and keep running into their very healthy 80s and 90s, my guest today doesn't buy the argument that humans are not designed for running. And he's tapped into a growing body of scientific evidence that suggests running barefoot, or nearly so, may offer better protection from injury than the most expensive state-of-the-art running shoes will ever do. Christopher McDougall is a contributing editor for Men's Health magazine. His new book is called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. Chris, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you.
You started all this with a very simple question. Why does my foot hurt? What kinds of injuries had you dealt with in your quest to go from short distance to long distance running?
You name it. Every 3 or 4 months, it was something else. Plantar fasciitis, which is chronic heel pain. Achilles tendonitis, which runs at the back of your calves. I had pulled hamstrings. The final breaking point was when I was told I had cuboid syndrome, which I didn't even know what a cuboid was. Somehow I'd broken it, and it's a cluster of bones in my foot. And the doctor said, look, you just got to give this up. You know, the human body is not designed for this kind of abuse, and particularly not your body.
And we should say you are quite tall.
Yeah, I'm 6'4", and back then I was about 230 pounds.
Mm-hmm. How were you training before?
I wasn't really training at all. I was just, you know, knocking out a couple miles every few days whenever I felt guilty about having eaten something the day before. But that was it. And the minor amount of running I was doing, I was being told, was really damaging to my body.
Were you just really bothered by the fact that other people seemed to be able to run without major problems?
Not really. Not at first, because I assumed that I was the same as everybody else, because the injury rate for runners is about 80% per year, and that hasn't changed in 30 years. So basically, everyone's in the same boat. Everyone gets hurt all the time, and it's never changed in my lifetime. So I assumed that this was normal.
Did you expect the answer to have anything to do with what you were wearing on your feet?
No, I didn't even know there was an answer. You know, what happened was I happened to be down in Chihuahua on a different magazine assignment, and I open this magazine, and I see this picture of what looks to me like this old grandfather in a bathrobe and sandals ripping down this rocky trail. And I read the caption, and it turns out he's a 55-year-old man who had just won a 100-mile race through the Rocky Mountains. And that's the first time I thought, wait a second, either it's got to be one of two things. Either he's some kind of genetic freak, and therefore I'm off the hook because I can't duplicate it, or he's just doing something differently than what I'm doing.
So let's talk about the Tarahumara tribe. They live in around Copper Canyon in Mexico, and in a pretty isolated place.
Yeah, they're down at the bottom of this spider webbing network of canyons, and they've basically been there in isolation for about 400 years, ever since the conquistadors arrived in Mexico. And the Tarahumara basically face a choice. They could either fight back like the Aztecs and the Mayans, or they could turn around and run. And they basically chose to run, which is why you have Tarahumara today and you don't have Aztecs.
And they live very primitively according to at least modern Western standards, but the culture you describe sounds idyllic. Very little violence, no apparent cancer or diabetes or obesity. Can you talk about a typical day for a Tarahumara Indian?
Well, this is one of the first things that intrigued me was when I discovered that they were master long-distance runners, then I quickly also found out that they seem to be immune from everything which plagues modern life. They have no diabetes, no heart disease, no cholesterol problems, no cancer rates, no domestic abuse, everything. I thought, boy, I wonder if this is a coincidence or if there's some connection there between their ability to run long distances and the fact that they seem to be healthy and nonviolent. But, you know, a typical day basically is very akin to what hunter-gatherers did for tens of thousands of years. You basically get up and try to find something to eat all day.
Given their isolation and the fact that they sort of skedaddled in order to get out of the path of colonialism, is it at least worth considering that they might have some sort of genetic tendency that allows them to thrive and run in those mountains?
Unfortunately, I think we tend to look to DNA whenever we're trying to excuse ourselves and not doing something. You know, why are Kenyans faster than us? For a long time, there was this theory, as proposed even by Runner's World magazine, that Kenyan marathoners had some kind of like a mutant lung gene that allowed them to process oxygen. It turns out, no, it's just baloney. They're just exactly the same. And with the Tatamata, it's the same. We are all, on this planet, 99.9% identical. The only difference is they do something and we don't.
So how did the Tarahumara run?
This was the most interesting thing of all. When I finally bushwhacked my way down there and encountered a Tarahumara settlement, I had the opportunity to watch a group of kids. The first Tarahumara I ever saw run were actually children. And the way they ran was unlike any other kind of running I'd ever seen before. First of all, the fact that you got 5- and 6-year-olds who are running a 10K at 9 o'clock in the morning during recess from their school. But on top of that, the way they moved was just weightless. They just seemed like they were falling through space. It was almost like skydiving horizontally.
So what is the typical distance for them if they just decide to go out on a run?
Well, for the grown-ups, that's anyone sort of over 14, a typical race will be anywhere between 150 and, say, 200 or 300 miles.
So one of the things that you discovered about, maybe training is the wrong word because this is just part of their lives, but they're not running flat on a track or on a course or even through a neighborhood sort of the way we would. They're stopping and starting and moving through space, and they have games that sort of help them train.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that we started to uncover is that, you know, humans are designed for endurance. We're not designed for speed. You know, we're actually very slow compared to basically every other mammal. We're in last place. You know, we are very proud of Usain Bolt for his 100-yard dash, but there's a dozen animals that could tear him a new one with no problem. And the difficulty is that we have constructed our races for what we're worst at, which is speed, whereas the Tarahumara focus on what we're best at, which is endurance. And the way the Tarahumara run is very similar to the way hunter-gatherers used to hunt down game. They run in a group, and they shift the lead back and forth. Someone will take point and other people will lag behind. And they'll always run communally, so the fastest runner is no faster than the slowest.
What I think is really amazing is this theory that we started hunting animals long before we had tools, because there's a possibility that we were literally running our prey to death.
You know, there are several certain mysteries in human history which have never been resolved. And as leery as I am of anybody who suddenly pops up with some little sort of key to prehistory which explains everything, what's interesting is that if you look at certain mysteries and you introduce long-distance running, suddenly these puzzles seem to snap into place. For instance, you have the fact that 2 million years ago, the human brain suddenly exploded in size and went from a little peanut to the size of a melon. And that could only have happened if those early humans had access to animal proteins. And that's a scientific certainty. Early humans, Homo erectus, was eating animal flesh. The problem is, that was 2 million years ago, and the first weapons only appear on the scene 200,000 years ago. So the mystery is, how on earth were these humans getting food for 1,800,000 years without any weapons? You know, there's another mystery as well, which is that women, and I mean this, Chris, with all due respect, but as a sprinter, you're terrible. You're awful.
you know that without even having met me. You're right.
And you're no good at the mile either, and you're probably pretty good at the marathon, because there's only about a 10-minute gap between the fastest male marathoner and the fastest female marathoner. Then you get into distances of 50 to 100 miles, and suddenly the playing field is absolutely level. You can take the best women on any given day, and they can beat the best men in a 100-mile race. Which makes you wonder, why is it that women are getting stronger as distances get longer? There are several other mysteries like this, and they only make sense if humans evolved as hunting pack animals, because the pack has to stay together.
So the women would have to keep up with the men, even if the men were actually taking the prey.
Exactly. Well, and there's no reason why the women weren't taking the prey either, because what you do is, all other mammals, apart from humans, vent heat by respiration, and humans vent heat by perspiration. So at some point, a horse, a cheetah, a gazelle, it has a choice. It can either breathe, can get air or it can cool off, but it can't do both at the same time. Humans can, which is why we can run ultramarathons in Death Valley in July with no difficulty. You can put a man against a horse in a 25-mile race, and the man will win every time. So you just run the horse into heat exhaustion.
So another advantage that we have is that we are hairless, and I guess that helps us keep cool.
Yeah, exactly. It helps us keep cool. It lets us not absorb heat through a dark surface and also through perspiration.
So why do so many humans seem to hate running today?
You know, it's funny. There are two answers to that question. One is a biological answer, and this was introduced to me by this really great scientist, Dr. Dennis Bramble, who's one of the leading thinkers on what he calls the running man theory, the theory that humans evolved as hunting pack animals. And I asked him that same question. I said, okay, if it's supposed to be good for us, it should be rewarding. We should not hate it. And he said, the problem is that for almost all of our existence, we were always in pregame. We never knew when the moment would come when we would suddenly have to leap into action and run 20 or 30 or 50 miles. So the brain became this great conserver of fuel. The brain was always telling your body, take it easy, relax, don't waste any energy, because you never know when you have to spring up and run. The difficulty is only in modern times, in the past 50 years or so, we have removed all necessity to move. We have everything at arm's reach. And our brain is still telling us, hey, sir, you save your energy. But now there is no emergency. There is no necessity to leap up and run a marathon. But it is kind of intriguing, though, that you know, every few months or so, tens of thousands of people will gather on a street corner and suddenly run 26.2 miles. You know, you wouldn't see that anywhere else in the animal kingdom.
Was distance running something that you were always interested in, even before you did it yourself?
Not particularly. I, you know, used to row and play basketball, and this was sort of by default. You know, every time I got injured with another sport, I would sort of gradually work my way down to the lowest common denominator, which was distance running.
How competitive are the Tarahumara with each other when it comes to running?
They are competitive within settlements, but, you know, people have asked, well, these guys are so great, how come they're not tearing up the Olympics every 4 years? And the reason why is they've actually tried to bring the Tarahumara up to the Olympics. And this notion of, like, blasting off for individual glory is kind of weird and unfulfilling to the Tarahumara. Again, keeping in mind that humans evolved as endurance animals who run in packs, that's how the Tarahumara compete. What they like to do is get together, two settlements will get together, and they'll just party like bandits all night long, betting like crazy, drinking like madmen, until the next morning. At that point, they'll decide how long they're going to race. They won't even know how long the race is going to be until shortly before the beginning of it. And the way they run is you'll have two teams. Each team will have a wooden ball about the size of a baseball. And the way the team runs is by flicking that ball from teammate to teammate as you run back and forth over a course, which is about a mile or so. You may run that course 150 or 200 times. But again, the team moves as a unit, and you're moving back and forth fast and slow as you progress that ball.
And the women compete as well as the men?
Yeah. As children, boys and girls are all together. As they get older, because you've got the necessities of looking after kids, the men and women split into separate races. But the women's races tend to be about 60 to 80 miles long.
And they have not a ball, but like some kind of a hoop device?
Yeah, exactly. Right. They roll the hoop. Something very sort of maternal and sort of earth motherish about it, the symbolism.
And they're doing it in like floor-length skirts.
Yeah, right. Long skirts and wrist-length blouses. Yeah.
Christopher McDougall is my guest. He's a contributing editor to Men's Health magazine. His new book is called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christopher McDougall. He's a contributing editor to Men's Health magazine. His new book is called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. So, Chris, you mentioned earlier that before these big races between different villages, the Tarahumara will sort of party like it's 1999. What do they eat while they are running these races, and how do they eat?
They eat very sparingly, and they eat pretty much the same thing they would eat in normal life, which is pinole, which is ground corn, and chia, which you might be familiar with from chia pets. And chia was like the sort of the magical food of early America. Chiapas, the province of Chiapas, is actually named after chia seeds, but they're just bursting with protein and amino acids and omega oils. So they'll dilute that in a little bit of water, squirt a lime and some honey, and gobble it right down.
And we're getting back to the barefoot thing here. They wear on their feet what amounts to just sort of a tire track sandal.
And that's what really piqued my interest at first. When I saw this picture of the 55-year-old in his sandals, he just ran the equivalent of four consecutive marathons. I've been told that one marathon is the ultimate challenge and it's going to wreck my knees. And this guy's in sandals. And I thought, now how is it possible that he's running with no heel or motion control or arch support or orthotics? And he's fine. But yes, that's what they wear. They used to make them out of deer skin, and now they'll salvage old tire rubber and fashion them into sandals.
So when you tried or were about to try running barefoot, you could not find a doctor who said this was a good idea.
Exactly. And to this day, you won't hear it. Podiatrists will always tell you that it's not a good idea, that people just run the way they run, and any problem you have can be addressed by buying something as opposed to changing something. And I was really surprised to realize that they are so far off the mark that, you know, running is the only activity where if you're doing it wrong, they tell you to just keep doing it that way and just buy something else. If you swim improperly, no one says, here, put this wetsuit on, it'll constrict your arm. No, they correct your stroke. If you play, you know, no one just golfs the way they golf. So that was the thing, was nobody ever told me, not in a running shoe store, not a podiatrist, not a sports medicine doctor, no one ever told me to change the way I ran, and that was the secret.
I was really amazed that there is not, at least, and you looked for them, a study that says that running shoes prevent injuries.
Isn't that insane? The fact that we've been buying these things for 30 years, and to this day, there is not one study that has ever demonstrated that these things do anything.
Well, and in their defense, they do spend a lot of time and energy and scientific research trying to figure out how to make your leg sit the way it's supposed to sit when you take a stride.
Why is that in their defense? It doesn't work. I mean, if running shoes were a drug, they'd yank these things off the market. It's crazy. They spend a lot of money advertising these things and dressing them up. I mean, think about this. If any running shoe worked, why do they change them every 6 months? Every fall, actually every quarter, there's brand new running shoes out there. You have a variety of shoe called a motion control shoe. Well, think about it. Either it controls the motion or it doesn't. How do you update this thing every 6 months if it's only supposed to control motion?
And one of the things that the people who now are starting to look at running barefoot, one of the things that they will say is that what these shoes ultimately do is weaken the muscles within the foot itself.
These things are a health hazard. And again, I am among the most surprised to have discovered this because I love running shoes. They're so comfortable. They look good. They smell good. They're wonderful. What I found is my problems were caused by the shoe. And the reason I know this is because when I got rid of the shoes, I got rid of the problems. I can run 100 miles a week, injury-free, no trouble, not a twinge of pain. When you think about what a running shoe does, it is the exact opposite of what you would normally engineer for your foot. I mean, think about this. If you have a heightened heel, that necessarily forces your body forward, which means you've got to curb your spine backwards. It also allows you to land on your heel, which you could never do in a naked foot. The heel is all bone and nerve. You would never land on a heel. And finally, the big one is your arch is designed, like every arch in creation, to bear weight from above. That's how an arch works. the Romans knew this when they were designing the aqueducts. The more weight you push down from above on an arch, the more the parts mesh and the stronger it gets. You would never, ever put a support underneath an arch because it pushes up and weakens the arch. And yet, that's what we do with our running shoes.
And things changed literally for you instantly when you started running barefoot. Can you talk about your experience?
Yeah, you know, actually, I wouldn't even mind leaping ahead to the unwritten epilogue to the book because something happened was once I had learned to run like the Tarahumara and was up on my forefoot and keeping my feet underneath my hips, the first thing was it began to feel utterly weightless. I was just falling forward through space. It felt fantastic, so easy and free. Once I had changed my biomechanics and then I went from not being able to run at all to actually being able to train for a 50-mile race against the Tarahumara. This all happened within 9 months, from zero up to running 50 miles in 9 months. But subsequently, while I was working on the book, I live in Pennsylvania. We got a ton of snow. It was very slushy. At that point, I figured I have perfect biomechanics. I can afford to put a pair of running shoes back on so I don't have to run through the snow. Next thing I knew, my heel started to hurt, and I couldn't figure out why until someone videotaped me and said, look, man, you've totally regressed. You're back to running the way you were before. And I wasn't aware of it because I couldn't sense the ground anymore with that big, thick cushion on my foot.
Yeah, how different are the steps that you take? You talked about sort of, I know that you ran more on the balls of your feet when you were running barefoot.
You know, I try to demonstrate it for people, and they look at me and go, hey, you look the same to me. What you're really picking up on is, this morning, for instance, I was out for a one-hour run in my bare feet on an asphalt road. And my left foot, for some reason, started to feel a little bit tender under the ball of the foot, and I couldn't figure out why. And then it took me about 5 or 6 strides to realize, oh, I'm sort of leaning over a little bit. And once I leaned back to the right, that tenderness vanished. But if I'd been wearing running shoes, I never would have gotten that feedback. I would have just finished that entire one-hour run off balance, never felt it at all, and I would have been building up accumulated stress, which eventually would have resulted in an injury. But because I was in bare feet, I instantly felt it, instantly adjusted, and solved the problem.
Christopher McDougall is my guest. We're talking about his book, Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. We have an email here from Stephen. He says, the Tarahumaras are wonderful people. Would you care to comment on the story surrounding the Tarahumaras running and winning an Olympic marathon only to be disqualified for having run barefoot?
Yeah, that never happened. the Tarahumara, that's sort of combining several different things. They did compete in Amsterdam and in Mexico City, and they weren't disqualified. They actually sort of finished sort of back in the pack. For two reasons. One is that the Tarahumara who are easiest to recruit for races are the last ones you want to recruit because that means that they are living somewhere near modern society and chances are they're no longer practicing traditional long-distance running. But secondly, you know, they run as a pack. They don't run out in the front. They were disqualified from a 100-mile race, but that was a whole other saga involving this really disreputable explorer who recruited a group of Tarahumara, brought them up to the U.S. for ultramarathons, and the Tarahumara just kicked the tar out of everybody, won these races going away, but the explorer who's managing them was up to such hijinks that race director after race director had to disqualify them from races.
Let's go to Dan in Dallas. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Chris. Great show. I just heard the gentleman mention, actually, I may have not gotten all of the comment, but the tail end of it, but I'll present my comment and I'll get my answer off the air. The gentleman said, you know, there is no study so far that shows that running shoes like Nike or whatever, the brand names, make any difference in actually running. My experience being that if you try to run even half a mile in your dress shoes, or God forbid, in bare feet and in any kind of terrain or surface, you will know why running shoes are such a good idea. So I just wanted to get the comment on that.
Thanks for your call, Dan. What do you think, Chris?
I think if you try to run in your bare feet as if you were in shoes, you'll get injured because shoes allow you to do things which you cannot naturally do in your bare feet. But again, I run all the time on my bare feet, and I feel no difference whatsoever. I feel no difference in impact if I'm running on asphalt or on grass. To me, it feels exactly the same because the shock absorption is coming from my three-foot-long compressible leg as opposed to this little quarter inch of flabby foam.
Can you talk? You do wear some kind of sole protection on your foot. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, what I'm wearing at this very moment is a thing called the Vibram 5 Finger, which is just like the coolest invention I've ever come across. It is a rubber foot glove, and it basically just adds an extra layer of skin to the bottom of your foot.
And these things, you actually see each toe individually, so I guess they're also favored by climbers.
Yeah. Well, they're actually originally designed for yacht racers. It was a boat shoe. But then the barefoot running underground discovered these things and jumped on them like jackals, and they love them because it feels exactly as if you were in bare feet, just with a little bit of abrasion protection under your sole.
And do you have to change those out every, 500 miles, like running shoes are supposed to be replaced?
No, I don't know what the lifespan of these things are. I've had a pair, I've been running it for a year and a half, and they look brand new. I mean, I think these things are indestructible.
Let's go next to Isaac in Dallas. Hello, Isaac.
Yes. Hey, I've got a question. Tell me again, before I get to my question, tell me again what those things you're talking that you're running now. What is that called?
They're called the Vibram, V-I-B-R-A-M, 5 Fingers.
Okay. Do you think a normal running store would have those?
I'm sorry, what's that? A normal running?
Running store?
A normal running store. Is that a common?
You can find them online.
Yeah, they're a little tricky to find. You can find them online or in outdoor shops.
Okay. All right, my question was similar to that. My feet are crazy tender, the bottom of my feet are, and I was wondering, not running shoes, but like racing flats that you would buy, racing flat shoes. You have to say about them?
I went to racing flats myself, but what I find is I really like to get my toes involved and I like to spread them out and splay them and sort of grip the surface. So I occasionally wear racing flats, but when I do, I wish I were back barefoot again.
Going back to the evolution thing, the fact that humans have very short toes compared to our primate ancestors has something to do with the theory that we are, in fact, evolved to be good runners.
Yeah, Professor Daniel Lieberman at Harvard, he's the chair of evolutionary anthropology at Harvard, he's worked up this entire menu of running animal components. And his starting point was, okay, if you're going to design a running animal, what would you give it? And we tend to have all those things. And what doesn't have all those things are animals like pigs and chimps, which are actually closely related to us, but they lack things like, for instance, short toes, a thing called the nuchal ligament, which is in the back of your head, which stops your head from swaying around, big butts. We've got, big old, you wonder why we have big butts. Well, that's the reason why, because it's only useful for running. And Achilles tendons. We have Achilles tendons, which give you elastic recoil, and chimps and pigs don't.
Let's go to Mary in Dallas. Hey, Mary.
Yeah, hi. I know you kind of answered the question, but I was wondering, since he doesn't wear shoes, but for other people like us that need to wear the shoes for other purposes or whenever you do wear shoes, I know you're talking about the five-toe shoes. Are there any other shoes, or what's the best kind of shoe to wear?
Moccasins. Moccasins are awesome, and you can find sort of all variations of them, but that's basically a barefoot shoe, and that's what the Native Americans wore for a long time.
So all the shoes that you wear basically throughout the day now are soft-soled things that don't really feel like shoes.
Well, I'm lucky because I work at home, so I'm pretty much barefooting all the time. But when I'm out in public, I like to wear these 5 Fingers a lot, which is a bit cumbersome because I'm constantly answering questions about them. But I wear moccasins, flip-flops, or the 5 Fingers.
800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Matt in Denton. Hello, Matt.
Hello. I was wondering about how shoes would benefit those with scoliosis. He was talking about how running barefoot corrects your posture and things like that. But for those who have, sort of an off posture because of scoliosis, would running shoes actually benefit them to help restore balance and even weight distribution?
Well, we will say, before Chris answers, he's not a physiologist, but I don't know if you have any thoughts about any of this.
All I'll say is this, is that, running shoes have yet to prove their value to do anything. If there were a running shoe that would help scoliosis, you would know it because they would advertise it. If running shoes did anything, they would advertise it. And what's fantastic about what the running shoe industry has pulled off for 30 years is you've never seen an ad that actually says it does anything. They never say, wear this shoe and you will not get runner's knee, or wear this shoe and it will strengthen your ankle. Nothing. So my feeling is, again, not being the guy who designs these things or tests them, I'm waiting for the running shoe industry to put up or shut up. What exactly do these things do?
My mom and my sister are big fans of those Maasai trainers. Have you seen those? They have kind of a rocking sole. What do you think about those?
Well, you know, I'm sort of curious about that because, again, they're designed to make you move as if you were barefoot naturally. Why don't you just cut out the middleman and just, you know,
that they cost like $300, so you could
save
yourself a chunk of change.
Yeah, I keep, you know, the Nike Free is like a $100 shoe that's designed to make you run as if you were barefoot. Well, you know, save $100.
Do you, and you run on every conceivable surface?
Yeah, I was just traveling around for the past 5 weeks in Europe and the U.S., and it was literally a different place every day, and I was running with different groups every morning. So one morning I was in Boston, and it was like 50 degrees, and I was running with Dr. Lieberman on the Charles River, and the next morning I woke up, it's 102 degrees in the Phoenix Desert, and I ran in the Five Fingers everywhere, every time, or bare feet, and never had a problem.
An email from Harvest wants to know what you think about running barefoot on a treadmill.
I hate treadmills. You know, the treadmill, I don't understand why you would ever lock yourself up in an artificial environment when there's so much cool stuff outside. And secondly, the problem with a treadmill is you are running to keep up with the treadmill, so you are always in danger of getting your foot ahead of your center of gravity, and that's where you get into trouble. The bare feet won't hurt you at all. That's fine. I think trying to catch up with this spinning orb is going to cause problems for you.
Christopher McDougall is my guest. He's a contributing editor to Men's Health magazine. His new book is called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here with Christopher McDougall from Men's Health magazine. His new book is called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. Chris, for people who want to convert to barefooted running, the advice typically is that you sort of step down from a traditional running shoe to something a little thinner and then finally into some kind of barefoot shoe. You didn't do that. Would you recommend that people follow your course?
Yeah, I would just go whole hog, get naked right away. Because the thing about it is that you know, your foot is one of the most sensitive parts of your body. It's as sensitive as your genitals. And by going barefoot, it prevents you from over anything. You can't overtrain, overpronate, overstride in a barefoot. Your barefoot will tell you what you need to do.
Have you had the experience, and I know you wear these shoes most of the time, but these barefoot shoes, but have you stepped on a pebble or something that was just excruciatingly painful?
Sure, yeah, you know, but nothing wrong with pain. You know, pain the thing about pain, though, is pain is telling you something, like, don't do that next time. But most of the time, you know, I like to rely on these really high-tech device I have. It's called eyes, you know. If I see the thing, I just step the other way.
So you sort of scan the ground ahead of you as you go.
Yeah, but it makes you so in tune with what's going on, just that. Sometimes people ask me, like, you know, when I go on a four-hour run, like, what do you think about? I'm like, man, I'm thinking about the next step.
Let's go next to Plano, where we'll speak with Chris. Hey, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you. We've got three Chrises on the line right now.
Full house.
am I the one that's talking?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm a competitive cyclist, and I came across your information as I was trying to transition over into triathlons. And I was just so happy to find out about it because I jumped in. I didn't actually do the transition, the slower transition, and it's done amazing things. I used to have horrible shin splints and, you know, different kind of problems, and now I run, and I'm not really having any problems anymore. But one of the things is I'm taking a class right now of concepts of physical fitness and wellness, and I was trying to approach the teacher about, you know, the benefits of this. And he also happens to teach the running class, and he just wasn't really receptive to it at all. And what do you find is the best way to get through to people like that?
You know, the resistance is really sort of unbelievable and so emotional. But, I mean, to this day, Runner's World magazine still defines running by heel-toe transition. If you go to a running shoe store where that's supposed to be your first point of reference, they will always have you walk and then judge the way you're landing on your heel. There is some fascination, this sort of like zealous fascination with a heel landing. And I have yet to figure out how to change people's minds. People just dig in their heels, so to speak, and will not relent.
Do your heels, when you're running, effectively not hit the ground?
They tap back. It's what Dr. Lieberman calls a reverse strike. Hmm. What a lot of coaches have been preaching is the heel strike, which makes no sense. If you're running down a hill and you want to stop, what do? You straighten your leg and you plant your heel. That's your natural break. You don't want to be breaking. You want to be progressing forward, so you land on the ball of your foot and bend your knee. But what you do is you basically land on the ball of your foot, and then your heel will tap down very gently as a way of bending that arch, and then the arch springs forward and pops your foot forward.
Let's go next to Tanya in Frisco. Hello, Tanya.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And my question is, for someone like me, I love running, and I had to stop because, one, I don't have an arch. So I constantly have calluses on the ball of my foot, and I'm constantly having, I have horrible knees. So, you know, I'm constantly feeling pain in my knees, and I've gotten those little knee straps to go around, you know, the bottom of your, the bottom of your kneecap and so forth. But what would you recommend for someone like me who really loves to run but just has a lot of trouble running, especially you were just mentioning the heel to toe movement? What would someone do who actually doesn't have an arch? I don't know what to rely on.
I've got something great for you. Well, Alan Webb, who's the great American miler right now, when he was in high school, he had no arch. He had flat feet, and he's a size 12. And his coach had him start walking barefoot and doing barefoot running drills, and his arch gradually came back up, and now he has a high arch, and he's a size 9. So he basically reduced 3 shoe sizes, and his arch came up. So the arch is basically supported by muscle. Your problem is those muscles have atrophied. But here's a good short-term solution. Jump rope. Get a jump rope, and what you'll find is you'll start building up that elastic recoil that you'll need in your legs, which will strengthen your knees. It'll teach you how to land the balls of your feet. And you won't have to worry about getting calluses on your arches because they won't be contacting the ground. Jump rope for a couple of weeks and then try running a little bit.
It's so counterintuitive, Chris, you know, because people, when they talk about running shoes, especially for those with knee problems, they talk about the benefits of all that cushioning, absorbing the impact of sort of bone on bone.
It's nonsense. It's totally made up. I mean, show me the study. Show me the study that shows that any of that foam absorbs any impact. It doesn't. I was actually at the running injury clinic at the University of Delaware, and I ran across an impact plate wearing 3 different kinds of footwear. No footwear, the Nike Free, and a cushioned Nike Pegasus. What they discovered was I had the least amount of impact in my bare feet and the most amount of impact in my cushioned shoes. Why is that? Because the shock absorption that you want comes from the leg, not from the foam. I mean, think of how long your leg is and how it can compress till your butt is down on the ground. You've got all that shock absorption. The foam really does nothing, but it does trick your leg into feeling that it needs to reach out for stability, and so your foot is slamming down harder looking for that solid surface.
Let's go next at 1-800-933-5372 to Tom in Forest Hills. Hey, Tom.
Hi. Thank you so much for this wonderful show. I've been really enjoying listening in.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have a comment, and then I have a question about the tribe in Mexico. And my comment is that I'm a runner, but I don't get to run as often as I'd like to. I started running barefoot about 3 or 4 years ago, and I can definitely agree. What I found was that I started to run more towards the front of my foot under the ball of the foot. And when you are going into barefoot running, you have to start by just walking around the block barefoot because, you know, the bottom of your feet is very tender and not used to it. And definitely it strengthens all those parts of the feet, just as you've been saying. So that is my comment about my experience of barefoot running. And it's a wonderful feeling when you get the chance to do it. Now, my question is about the tribe that does these amazing races. What is their relationship, or how is their status in the country that they live in Mexico? What's their position within the country's government, or kind of the
so glad you asked that question, Tom, because we can sometimes lose sight of their humanity in our fascination with their athleticism. The difficulty with the tautomata is that the candle is really flickering. They are an imperiled race. There are probably maybe only 40,000 of the tautomata that still exist. And the reason why is because the Mexican government keeps pushing roads down into these canyons, which allow illegal loggers to come in, which allow drug traffickers to come in, and the tautomata get dispersed and shoved out of their traditional homelands. So I think one of the real tragedies is that when we look at the tautomata, we are looking back at a portal back through time to what we all once were. I believe that we all live like the tautomata, and they are really the best we could be. If we are trying to get rid of crime and violence and heart disease and other obesity problems in our country, they've got the secret, and yet we're watching them become extinct in our own lifetime.
We have an email here from Shauna in Dallas, who has obviously read the book. She wants to know how Jen, Billy, Scott, Eric, and Barefoot Ted have fared in ultramarathons since the Copper Canyon Ultra that you wrote about.
Oh, man, Shauna, it's worthy of another book. So much has gone on with this cast and crew, but I will say this, that Scott Jorick, who is the greatest living ultra runner, has continued his glory. He's gone on to win the Spartathlon. He's broken records at Hard Rock. He broke the record at Badwater. Billy's living out of a car in Hawaii right now, living the dream. Jen is tearing up the ultra circuit. They've all just gone on to continued glory.
For people who don't follow this stuff, it might be surprising to learn that sort of traditional marathoners who go the 26.2 miles or whatever it is tend to look down on ultramarathoners.
You know, it's unfortunate because ultrarunners don't look down on marathoners. But, you know, marathoners have this fascination with speed that, you know, go as hard as you can from gun to tape, which is, you know, not really what we're designed to do. Ultrarunners are more about challenging themselves on terrain and distance. Jen and Billy were these two surfers from Virginia Beach, and they were looking for some exotic challenge. The first race either of them ever ran was 50 miles through the Blue Ridge Mountains. Jen's second race was 100 miles through North Carolina. At the 50-mile mark, she popped a handstand, ate a cheese pizza, drank some Mountain Dew, and then she broke the course record by 3 hours. But again, she wasn't trying to run as fast as she could. She was just in the moment, enjoying the day.
Let's go next to Sarah in Plano. Hello, Sarah.
Yeah, hi. This is great because for the past week I've seen this 60-something man run around our park barefoot, and now I know why.
I mean, the fact
my question is twofold. You talked about the Zimba shoes. I don't know how much they cost, but you would just recommend, what about walking, and what about walking barefoot without those foot covers?
They're, what, about $75?
Yeah. You know, the thing about the Five Fingers, I love them, but it's a lot of money for not a lot of shoe. So I would say go the path of least resistance, which is go barefoot first and then see if you need anything. I love the fact that 60-year-old man is running barefoot. That suggests to me that the reason why he's still running age 60 is because he's barefoot.
Let's go next. We have time to talk to Amanda in Dallas. Hey, Amanda.
Hi. I did this running in the summer, and I have to run about 4 to 5 miles and plus do the stadium, run up and down the stadium stairs at a college nearby, and I did it several times, and I was wondering what he recommended.
In terms of what to wear on your feet or how to run it?
Yeah, both. Or what do you want me to do for the stadium steps? What's the best?
Oh, yeah. You know, the thing about steps is I think that this is a theory I'm just sort of playing with now, but I can't prove any of it. But I think that humans are really well adapted to climbs. Part of what the gluteus, your butt muscles do, is they help you go up things. But, Amanda, all the time, just let gravity be your friend. When you're going up stadium steps, lean forward as if you're falling into the steps and just let your leg whip around and try to flow up the stairs. That's what the tautomata, how they run up the side of a canyon. They basically fall into the face of the canyon and let gravity pull them up the slope.
Makes it sound so much easier than what we might imagine going up stadium steps for hours and hours. All right, final call we'll take is from Kevin in Saginaw. Hey, Kevin.
Hi. I've been looking into barefoot running in the past weeks, and the others, what I'm hearing from the other side is that for people who pronate, like myself, or over-pronate, barefoot running might be a bad idea because pronation is due to a bone structure rather than foot muscles. And I'm wondering what your response is to that.
Chris, what do you think?
You cannot overpronate in a barefoot. Overpronation comes from landing on your heel, and then your foot rolls far in toward the big toe. And if you go over too far in the big toe, that's overpronation. You land the ball on your foot, you cannot roll. You cannot pronate. This whole double-barreled nonsense, one about overpronation, secondly about some people have the weird bone structure, it's just baloney. It's just not true. And if you go barefoot and land the ball on your foot, your pronation problems are gone.
So I have to imagine that the Vibram people love your book, but I'm curious about the response, if there's been any, from Nike and Adidas and Reebok and all those folks.
Yeah, it's about time they cowboy up and say something. They've been keeping, I think, a disrespectful silence because the evidence is so strong against them and has been mounting now for years, and their response is just to ignore it and hope that people are too dumb to pay any attention.
So what advice would you offer someone who wants to start tomorrow?
Oh, I'd say start today. Take off your shoes. Take off your shoes and go outside in the grass a little bit. Spread your toes. Do some jumping jacks. Do some little sort of jumping drills. Get used to that sense of bouncing on the ball of your foot. And then, biggest advice of all, and this is what I learned from the Tadaumata, take it easy. Just go easy. Relax. Don't feel like you got to go do something. If you go out for your run, do what you feel like. If it's 50 yards or a half mile, stop there. If you want to do more, do more. But don't feel like you got to go bang out 5 miles.
Yeah, you were told if it feels like work, you're working too hard.
Best advice I've ever gotten for anything. right before this 50-mile race, I was starting to choke up, and the guy who was coaching me said just that. Just relax. Ease into it. When you want to go hard, go. When you want to back off, back off. And that made 50 miles actually seem easy.
Christopher McDougall is a contributing editor for Men's Health magazine. His new book is called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. Chris, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
I had a blast. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.